Good morning, good evening, good day, and everything in between, ladies, gents, and associated denizens of this beautiful earth. You are listening to Hidden Apron Radio, episode 23, with me, Paulo Espanola, and I hope you are staying warm out there as temperatures here in New York have finally gotten low enough for us to see some snow. If this is your first time listening in, welcome. This show is all about showcasing the stories of the people who make up our delicious world of food. We don't only focus on the art and technique of cooking, but really the many ways food affects our lives, whether it's conversations around culture, economics, or even the nuts and bolts of nutrition, because we do believe that food is not only reserved for the kitchen and dining table for those with the luxury of time, but it's also our universal language that can one day bring us closer together. As we say here, break bread and break boundaries. We don't only feature celebrated chefs, but everyone who has an interesting story to tell, from baking bloggers turned YouTube stars, bankers turned farmers and hunger eradicators, grade schoolers who've competed on MasterChef Junior, and in the case of our next guests, plural, an accountant and an architect turned ramen chef and Japanese restaurateurs. Lena Go and John Ng, who run probably the only izakaya or Japanese-style pub in Minnesota called Zenbox Izakaya, met many years ago in an online chat room, long before Tinder was but a twinkle in many a lonely single's eye. A long-distance romance blossomed into a move from seafood-rich San Francisco to Minnesota, where they first opened Zenbox Japanese Eatery, a quick-service lunch spot in the iconic Minneapolis skyways. Basically the intricate tunnel system between buildings so Minnesotans can keep warm from the colder-than-Mars temperatures during the winter. At the time, they specialized in bento boxes, but now they've since opened Zenbox Izakaya with a focus on traditional foods eaten inside a Japanese izakaya. Think like small shareable plates, as well as Chef John's specialty, ramen. This episode is chock full of info, as Lena and John were not only able to share their insights into the restaurant industry, but also leverage their backgrounds as non-Japanese, trying to bridge a misunderstood cuisine in the land of 10,000 lakes, and how they've applied their accounting and architecture background to their business. We talk about how they did their initial research before opening the restaurants, how they designed that first menu and created a balance between the traditionally Japanese and the local palate, their approach to educating an unfamiliar audience to the cuisine, and their much-lauded community work outside of the restaurant with their advisory roles in the Minnesota Restaurant Association and the St. Paul Culinary College. As you can tell, this episode is going to go all over the place. So it's one of those episodes that I'm really, really excited for. And even just their stories, something that you don't hear much of today. I mean, us millennials have probably never even heard of what a chat room is or what dial-up internet looked like. So even if you aren't interested in practicing the fine art of ramen, or simply think that Japanese food is just your local deli sushi counter, this episode has a lot to teach in terms of business ideas, and more importantly, their wisdom on the beauty of taking chances, falling in love with your work, and the process of learning, rather than being married to an outcome. I haven't seen these folks for like 4 years since Zenbox's opening during my time in college, and so, as they say in Japanese, tanoshinde kudasai. Please enjoy my conversation with Lena and John. Lena and John of Zenbox Izakaya, welcome to Hidden Apron Radio.
Thanks for having us.
And sashiburi desu, as they say in Japan, because it has been 4 years since I've eaten here or even like spoke to you.
Yeah, right? It's good to see you again.
So when I was thinking of where to start this show, usually I would ask maybe an origin story. And I think what I found really interesting is that everything I looked online of where this story started wasn't like, oh, I remember cooking with my mom or I remember this trip to Japan. It always started with how you two met, which is not many stories begin like that, right? So I'm going to have to ask you to tell the story one more time of how you met, but also what you two were already doing in food at the time when you met.
Okay.
Well, We met in a chat room. That was back in 1996. And Internet chat room.
So for the millennial listeners,
we were still using dial-up.
It was dial-up internet, and we were doing ICQ. It's kind of like Messenger.
A comic chat.
A comic chat. And
so
then we
everybody
were using...
have the comic character.
Yeah, so you don't have a face, you don't have a photo, you just have a character, which is like a cartoon character. And my name was Betty Poop. Betty Boop. I'm sorry. And John was Arch Deluxe.
Arch Deluxe.
Which is the infamous McDonald's Arch Deluxe burger.
Because I was studying architecture back then. So to me, it's like I just have to put Arch right.
Yeah. And his first pickup line in the chat room was, you have a cute nickname.
Yeah.
That's all he said to me. And then we started chatting. And then I was like, I'm new to internet. Back then, it was just like, it just got popular. And chat rooms, like, you might meet creepy people. Yeah. So
I mean,
he
you
might
still
be
do.
A creep. We still do. And I'm kind of wary. I kind of, you know, like, patronize him. And we started chatting for about 3 months. And then we started...
Yeah, I wish you found out I am creepy.
Well, what was the chat room about? Is there like a topic? A certain like
there's no
like...
topic. Like,
so it wasn't like, oh, this is food lovers.
Yeah. Yeah. People just walk in and then start chatting with each other. It's more like a social, online socializing space.
Yes.
Basically.
So
we
talk about
anything.
So it's like
whatever.
If you were to go to a bar, except the bar was...
Pretty much.
Online, and there's no swiping
involved,
like on Tinder.
And it was exciting because it's like you get to meet people from other countries. I was in New Zealand time zone when I was online.
And I was in San Francisco time zone. So usually whenever we chat would be really late at night in San Francisco.
For you.
Yeah, for me.
Yeah.
Because I usually get up at school around that time while I was studying.
It's like midnight for you. Yes.
Past midnight.
Yeah.
So then, because there was no picture, right?
No.
No picture.
And there was only the nickname.
Nickname.
And there's plenty of people that you get to meet on every day. There's what drew you back?
We just talk about our heritage, like he's Chinese, I'm Chinese, and then we're like, you know, like
talk about schools, talk about work,
hobbies. It's kind of like meeting people, writing postcards, and just like doing pen pals.
Yeah.
That's how it was. And and we started, you know, 3 months later, we're like, okay, maybe I'll take a look at how you look like. And
3 months later. So it wasn't even in the first chat where you like send a picture?
No. It was really like...
No, it was 6 months after before we sent each other a picture.
Wow. Picture.
Yeah. And we were writing postcards. Yeah. And, and of course, we were still in school. And we were, you know... very poor. He was a very poor student in architecture. And I was, you know, working part-time and going to school full-time. And then I saved up enough and I went to San Francisco to meet him for the first time, which is about 6 to 9 months later.
Right.
Yeah.
Were you both... So when you say that you were both poor students and you were working part-time, was that already your entry into the food industry?
No.
I was.
So you were already working... Okay.
Already. I actually start working in the... food industry when I was in high school, sophomore.
Mm.
My very first job was a dishwasher in Denny's restaurant.
Denny's. Oh, man, I love Denny's.
But by the time I graduated from high school, they actually offered me a system manager job in Denny's.
Yeah.
So that is how long I work in Denny's. So I pretty much know the in and out of Denny's throughout my high school years.
Got you.
So, but after I... graduate from high school, when I go into college, I start working in, you know, various different style of Japanese restaurant. That's how my true encounter with Japanese food.
Right. But this wasn't out of the love for the food more than it was like, I need to pay my bills.
Yeah.
Got you.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
I mean, the initial start was pretty much, you know, it's something have to pay for my bill.
Yeah. So when you two met in San Francisco, was it already like... I already know all these Japanese cooking techniques. Let me like impress her with.
Not really.
Yeah,
really?
Well, I mean, you like to cook.
I like to cook.
You have to cook when you were little.
Yeah, when I was little, I have to cook for my family because my parents have to work full time.
Yeah.
So, and I have to take care of my 80 years old grandmother.
Mm.
And most of the time, you know, after school, I'm the only one there. I have to be responsible for cooking for her.
Mm.
And then my brother and sister too. So that's how I... You know, I pretty much started up cooking when I was 14 years old.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So that's early.
Before I moved to San Francisco, I was originally from Hong Kong.
Yeah.
So that's where I started cooking.
So then what happened next? So now you've finally met and you're already
Yeah.
Knee-deep in the industry.
You know, I was in San Francisco for 2 weeks. That was during my summer, school summer holiday, vacation holiday, mm-hmm. we call that in New Zealand. And went back and we dated long distance for a year and a half. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we kind of met, we only saw each other like every 6 months for like 2 weeks to a month. That's yeah. it. So only three times. And the second time when I went back to San Francisco, my mom came with me. And she's...
Did she like secretly tag along? Like, let me...
yeah, she was like, who's this guy you've been chatting with and writing postcards? And she went with me and to meet him. And she, you know, John passed the test because he was very patient and, you know, he was driving my mom around shopping in San Francisco.
Yeah, that's the easiest way to convince anybody.
Yeah. You know, it's like if you want to date the girl, you got to date the mom first.
Yeah, pretty
like,
much.
Yeah. Okay.
And I'm okay with, you know.
Yeah.
So he passed the creep test.
Yeah. And then? He passed the creep test. And I think a year and a half later, we decided to get married and that was it.
Yeah. And then she moved over to San Francisco.
Yeah.
Right. And this was the time when you both were still, you were in architecture, you were in accounting.
Yes.
A restaurant was still not... It wasn't like when you were like, one day we're going to get married, we're going to start a restaurant. It wasn't like that.
No, it wasn't like that.
Yeah. Not at all. You know.
I mean, in fact, I stay in architecture. After I graduated from architecture, I stay in the field for 7 years before we decided to open a restaurant.
And when you were, I'm ignorant of the architecture industry. My roommate was one, but mm-hmm. he was like, oh, I was drafting a lot. Was that, what were you doing as an architect?
Was it design? I was a project manager.
Got you.
I initially wanted to learn everything mm-hmm. because I was older when I was graduated from architecture. So I have to, you know, consider to kind of work harder than everybody
else. It's
like
you got to catch up.
Right. So I get into some smaller firm and, you know, I pretty much have to do everything mm-hmm. since day one. So, you know, I pretty much have to do all the drafting, all the negotiation with the city and mm-hmm. meeting with clients, coming up with specs and stuff.
Yeah.
At the same time and going to the job site with the contractor. So.
And the reason I ask about that and about the background in finance and accounting as well mm-hmm. is because later on when you talk about restaurant operations, mm-hmm. I think a lot of people only see the front side, right? A lot of what gets written up is the cooking.
Yes.
When, you know, there's some people that I ask, I'm like, what's the number one reason a lot of restaurants fail? They're like, yo, they don't know how to balance a balance sheet.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I'm asking a bunch of questions on the background of these skills that might not... on the first front be like, huh,
yeah.
it's a restaurant.
In hindsight, it really helped us a lot because with my background in accounting and finance, you know, I was working in a environmental remediation company I started as a data entry clerk, right? After we got married, you know, I moved to San Francisco, fresh grad, and I started as a data entry clerk for this company and was there for 5 years and was promoted to be a accounts receivable manager within that 5 years and helped me a lot in, because we deal a lot with the government contractors, with the, you know, like the Air Force, the Navy, and the little details that you have to really prepare for the proposals to get reimbursements for the contracts, helped me a lot in making sure that everything is, you know, in line, numbers and everything to the pennies. And so it helped me a lot in hindsight where, like, now that when we decided to quit our jobs, you know, the corporate jobs, because we were like, this is not going to go anywhere. Mm. We're not happy with what we're doing. We're making good money, definitely making good money.
Yeah. But also at the downturn of the economy too.
Yeah, that was the time when we decided, you know, this is a good time for us to just try it. We don't have any children. We've been married for 6 years. And we're like, let's just do something.
Yeah.
And we decided to just move to Minneapolis because we have a really good friend who also moved from San Francisco to Minneapolis.
Gotcha.
They have their own family business and they export soybeans to Japan.
Oh.
They actually have a special variety of soybeans from Fargo in Minnesota.
That they export to Japan?
They export to Japan. And they
supply, the natto.
Yeah, for the natto. Yeah.
I would have thought that they would have...
Right.
That's the biggest natto maker in Japan, that they have roots in Minnesota.
Get out of here.
Yeah. And that's the whole reason why we moved to Minnesota. And we were visiting them many times during the 5 years while we're working. We came to Minneapolis and we see there's a lot of needs for like really good authentic Japanese food.
Besides sushi.
Yeah. So we decided to do a bento.
And this is shop. So that's where you were in the Skyway and you saw this space that could be a good restaurant space. But I think one of the things that often just gets like a one-liner when I was reading online is you saw this space and you're like, okay, then it took us a year to write a business plan and we started. What was that like? You know, did you say, okay, when we saw this space, let's do a field study of how many people eat Japanese? Like, what was your process of deciding, okay, we're going to do it here and this is how we're going to open?
Wow, it took us a while.
It took us a year before we found a space. We were unemployed for a year in Minnesota. But that year actually gave us a chance to do a lot of research and development in terms of like the general demographics and also the kind of the general knowledge of Japanese food that, you know, back then, how people look at it in terms of Minnesota.
Yeah.
Because we were from San Francisco and, you know, in San Francisco, we were blessed. Like, Japanese food is just like any other food.
Yeah.
It's so common.
But not Minnesota.
But when we moved to Minnesota, Japanese food is actually pretty mysterious to a lot of people.
Or it's hybridized. Like restaurants that have Chinese, Thai, and
Right.
So
did you have a specific approach? Did you say like, you know, let's pull these people, or literally was just going to all the Japanese restaurants that you were...
Right. We do a lot of research. We would go and sit down and eat, you know, try the menu and, you know, observe like, okay, what are the typical dollar amount that people are willing to spend? How much do they know about Japanese food? Because they were like, some Japanese restaurants serving coconut shrimp, you know, the Skyway, which is very confusing to the consumers.
Yeah.
And we, you know, we got rejected a few times. We were looking at space all around the Skyway. We knew we wanted to do the Skyway in Minneapolis. We also looked at St. Paul. We were young. We looked young. Asian people look really young. So they look like, you know what you're doing?
We actually have a broker told us that you guys look so young, we don't even think you guys were the
age
you
were. Will be successful.
Wow. Yeah.
When we're proposing them the plan.
The business plan. We were writing business plans. We were going to banks. We didn't have any credit, good credit for getting a business loan. So banks were like, we like your business plan, but, you know, we don't know if you're going to be successful because restaurant has the highest failure rate. Yeah. So we tried a few times. So we were turned down a few times.
But we must say that a good business plan is very, very important.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Regardless of any business.
Yeah.
You know, you have to be realistic about, you know, the numbers and also the projection.
Yeah.
Especially,
and the concept.
Yeah, and the concept. You have to have a clear vision of all those things before you approach to the actual space itself.
So what pushed it over? What made someone say, okay, I'll take a chance?
It was pretty much the concept and also the realistic of the projection within that, you know, the demographic.
Yeah. And our landlord, who was the one that took us in at the 6 Quebec building in the Skyway, he's an entrepreneur himself. And he mentored a lot of young entrepreneurs, you know, in, I think it was, what college was it? I can't remember. Anyway, there was a local college that he is part of the board.
Mm.
And he's like, I believe you. Let's do this. And he let us rent his space. It was a newly renovated building too.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And so Larry Abdo was our landlord back then. And he believed in it. He's the whole reason why we were able to get in there.
Yeah.
Although
the
rent was not cheap. It's definitely very high. We were going through quite a bit of, it wasn't easy. The first 3-4 years was not easy for us.
Yeah.
We were barely paying ourselves enough. We made sure that we pay our employees before we pay ourselves.
Right.
We were actually, we did not pay ourselves any salary for the first 2-3 years. We just barely, we were staying for free, rent free with our friend who were also our business partners for a year and a half.
Yeah.
Before we could even afford.
So one thing that, to set the context for listeners who aren't familiar with Minnesota. First of all, natto, by the way, if anyone was wondering, is fermented soybeans. I will post a link in the show notes. I eat this stuff every week.
Right.
Like, I buy packs.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right? And my roommate's like, dude, that looks like some bodily fluid.
We even have a natto omelet in our
No, that's why I was reading. So. I'm like, they had natto the whole time when I ordered this. But that's one thing. The other thing, too, is when we've been talking about Skyway, you have to imagine that in the winter, Minnesota gets like hellishly cold. And the streets are empty. Everyone's in these skyways. So when we talk about the skyway, these are very high traffic areas. So when you say that it was difficult even just paying yourselves for 2 to 3 years, imagine that these are really high traffic areas. That's how hard it was running a restaurant in a place that's already naturally high traffic. So I just want to make sure people know the context of what that was. But why then did you choose the bento concept, like the lunchbox concept, and why the skyway?
I think partially is because the way people eat during lunch within that financial district, people don't have time to sit down, look through your menu, and then pick, you know, a nice meal. They just want something really quick.
Yeah. And affordable.
Yeah, and affordable.
Right.
And they want, basically, they want the most with what they get, with what they pay.
Sure.
So that is something, that's why I think we were thinking bento idea is such a permanent strategy we should go.
Because it fits the lifestyle.
Right.
Yes. And it's a combination of, like, if you know bento, it has different food groups in one box. Yeah. So it's a very balanced meal. Mm. And that's why it kind of come very nice with our concept and the name Zen Box. Because Zen itself is like a harmony.
Yeah.
So to us, you know, the concept of bento is a harmonious food groups with the carbs, the protein, and the vegetables. And so we decided to do that, and we want it quick. It's a counter service style, affordable, and it was a hit. You know, the first day when we opened at 10:30, and we were sold out by 12:30.
Did you get a sense for what made people gravitate towards the food? Was it a specific dish? Was it just the idea and the newness of it? What would you attribute being a hit to?
I think it's a combination. It's the new idea of the whole idea of bento, which you do have Chinese restaurant doing those kind of bento, but our idea was, besides serving your typical fried rice, lo mein, or orange chicken, or coconut shrimp. I think the menu itself was what determined what Zen Box in the Skyway was.
We had tonkatsu, we have ebi fry, we had...
and it was all made
chicken
from scratch.
Karaage. Yeah, chicken karaage, which is very typical bento boxes that you get in Japan.
Konbini even.
Yes, in Konbini. And so I think the authenticity, there was a lot of our customers were like, oh my gosh, this feels like New York. When they come to the restaurant, like, I feel like I'm in New York.
Yeah.
And that took us by surprise. And they really embraced the concept.
Yeah.
And they loved it. And
and using fresh ingredients to appreciate your customer too. And they recognize that.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the, you know, successful part of the hard work.
Yeah. So how then did that, and I'm going to save the questions of menu design to a bit, because I want to lump that together as a whole of how you craft designs around a Japanese menu across both the bento and the ramen. But how did that then transition from bento to ramen?
Because when I was in San Francisco, I work in several different style of Japanese restaurant. And one of the restaurant is actually Izakayan ramen restaurant. My chef, he used to make his own ramen noodle in his shop.
From scratch?
From scratch.
Good God.
And he was pretty much the first generation of ramen chef in San Francisco back then. And now he's retired and he went back to Hawaii to live. And that's how I start getting interest of making ramen and serving ramen. And, you know, it's really, it's just a strike of luck, I think. I happen to be working in those kind of, you know, Japanese restaurant to learn those kind of craft.
Yeah. Right. But what made you decide, you know, I mean, you were doing fine at the Skyway. What made you decide, you know, we're going to open a restaurant next to the Guthrie of all places and serve ramen?
It's the timing, I feel. Mm. Because back then, when
timing
we first opened...
Ignorance,
yeah. Back in 2003, when we first opened the Skyway, bento was still new. Ramen... it's not as in Minneapolis for back then. It's not known.
It wasn't even
or it was known, but the way, at least when I was in Wisconsin, we knew it as the
instant
noodles.
Right.
Right. And so we knew that it wasn't time. But of course, you know, we miss ramen so much because San Francisco, everywhere, there's ramen shops everywhere. And we miss ramen so much. So he was developing over the few years of us doing the Skyway location with the bento boxes. He's been developing
different broth different, yep. Bowl of ramen in the Skyway kitchen after everybody left.
After hours.
Yeah. Right, after hours. And then that's how the whole idea of ramen came into play.
Yeah.
And then
about 6 years later, we decided it's time for us to get the second restaurant.
Right.
And that's where the izakaya comes into place, where we decided to do a bigger menu with ramen focus for this concept.
In addition to the foods that you would normally find at izakaya, right?
Yes.
Right.
So my question here is, because when you talk about izakayas, and when I've been to Japan, the izakaya menus, not only are they varied, but they're humongous, right? How did you go about picking what's going to go on your menu that would, one, pay respect to the Japanese tradition? Because I know you had motsu on the
right,
which is that's risky.
Right. Yes.
Right.
But at the same time, you're also putting stuff that will go well with the palate of the Midwest. You know, the rich broth of a ramen, I would see, is going to be successful. How did you go about picking?
I think that's part of it. It came from, you know, all this year in Skyway, knowing the kind of the dietary of general public. What do they normally get in terms of, you know, either fry item, grill item, or pan fry item, or even though, you know, soup-wise, what kind of soup they like. So that's how we developed that palette in our izakaya menu. I mean, even though you look at, you know, stuff like tonkatsu, you know, it's really pretty much a fried pork. When you strip down everything without the name, it's a fried pork.
It's a pork chop. Like, it's like how we have pork chops over here.
It's a fried pork chop. It's like, how can people not like it? I mean, you basically, we were using the mentality of using the known ingredient with the Japanese touch in it, which still are pretty authentic in
and
terms
approachable.
Of, and approachable to introduce to the Minnesotan palate.
So that's
part of it is education, I think.
There were a lot of things on the menu that we wanted to put in there, but we were like, okay, this is going to work. This might not work.
Yeah.
And so it took us, we fought a lot on like, okay, I really want this on the menu. But he's like, no, what if the consumers don't like it?
Well, what is an example of that?
Like motsuni?
Yeah,
motsuni.
Like natto.
We had to compromise,
I'm surprised you put natto. That's even in Japan, like when I'm like, oh, you know, natto daisuki, they're like, are you sure? You know what I mean? So it I could appreciate the difficulty. What about the Japanese cuisine drew you? Because when I remember when I came, you had introduced yourself as not being Japanese. And when I read into the story, like, neither of you are Japanese. What was it about the culture that you were like, this is the culinary tradition we want to adopt and cook into?
Well, it kind of, for me, I've been thinking about this a lot. Where, why am I so crazy about Japanese food? When I was in New Zealand, you know, my first love was Japanese food. I just love my first non-sushi Japanese food that I love was katsudon.
Katsudon
and
I think you wrote about lamb teriyaki or something like that.
Yes, lamb teriyaki. And my mom used to cook that a lot. And for John, because of his background in working in Japanese restaurants.
Well, and also since I was little kid, because I was from Hong Kong. And as you know, Hong Kong was a British colony.
Right.
Back then, doing before 97. And when I grew up in Hong Kong, we don't get program like from China. We get program actually from Japan.
Yeah.
We actually watch more Japanese program than anybody else within the Asia country.
What?
We grew up with Japanese animation, Japanese songs, and Japanese drama. And all the variety show.
Yeah. So, all the game shows,
So that's how I learned about, you know, the culture ever since I was a kid. And then in addition of, you know, what I learned throughout my college life working in Japanese restaurants. So it just came naturally to me that this is what I want to focus on.
Yeah.
Right. Because I think the Japanese culture, one, when I went there, it seemed very, for lack of a better English word, it seemed very alien.
It was
only culture that I knew that was so different from my own of being Filipino that it was just like, wow, you know, and you see all the people who like what are they called? Otakus?
Mm. Yeah.
Yes. Right? And you always wonder, like, what is it about the culture that draws you? And I initially was guessing it was the design aesthetic, right? The Japanese culture has such a heavy emphasis on design, even in the food.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, have you stayed at the Ryokan?
Well, I mean, you know,
where they do the full kaiseki dinner.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
And I'm just like, who else would put this much attention,
right?
So I thought that's what the connection was going to be, and I could see it in the menu. But how did the Japanese culture also seep into the space and how you wanted the space to be set up? I know listeners can't see this, right? But
I think what drew me in is the history of the culture.
Mm.
And because I was studying architecture, I do study a lot of history of, you know, architecture throughout the world. And there's something I think attractive about Japanese design in terms of, you know, the whole mentality of the detail, how they pay attention to the detail.
Right.
And also respecting the whole history of nature. That is a big part of what I draw in.
Yeah.
And especially when I especially get interested in between the World War II periods, where, you know, they have the Japanese traditional culture, whereas they have that clash with the Western culture. That's the moment I have that. I guess I was fantasizing that moment of
creation
culture,
process,
right?
Yeah,
creation
yeah.
process. And I think that would work perfectly for America. Because you have something East and something West. But when you put them together, it has a new dynamic in terms of conceptual-wise.
Yeah, and I think it comes off really strong, even in your biography online, of respecting the tradition. But in addition to that, since we are in Minnesota, are there things that you've wanted to add on top? You know, things that in your message, right? I mean, the restaurant is the message. Every time you put a bowl of ramen, you're telling a message.
Right.
Is there something additional to what you've learned? What is signature John or signature Lena, for example, in the restaurant experience, but not just, oh, this is a Japanese tradition?
I think to me, this day is more about the ingredients.
Mm.
The more I understand about the local ingredient within Minnesota, the more I want to try different things, different techniques or the combination of Japanese techniques with
Minnesota ingredient.
Yeah. That's what draw me different than other restaurant, Japanese restaurant wise.
I think for John, it has come to a development for his own style in terms of putting our heritage into it, the Chinese heritage.
That's where I was going to lead next, actually.
Yeah.
So what did that look like?
It shows a lot in his ramen. You can see from his weekend specials where he's using a lot of, like the last one that we did is a five-spice
Tantanmen.
Using the Chinese five-spice, and then the Tantanmen, of course, originally is from China, but Tantanmen in Japan is a totally, they have their own...
The taste is a little bit different.
To accommodate but we want to combine that.
Right. So a lot of people don't know what five spice is, by the way. You just put the word five spice, people will automatically, what's so special is a powder. But my idea of five spice is using the real five different spice to create my bowl from scratch. So that's... Like, you don't see that in the bowl, but when you taste it, you can taste the difference.
Yeah.
And I think that's how my heritage came in to kind of develop my style. And a lot of other ingredients too. You might never, imagine you can put it into the ramen, but I did. And you can hardly tell in the bowl.
Yeah.
Because I blend it well with the knowledge of the traditional ramen itself.
There's the harmonious.
It's really the process.
Yeah.
It's all about the process and the research and development.
Yeah. And while still keeping the authenticity of, the craft of ramen
and the
and
flavor
Japanese
and then the techniques.
Yeah.
Was there a Minnesota ingredient that you were like, oh my God, I want to use that?
Mushroom. I love to use Minnesota mushroom.
Yeah.
We have a lot of variety of Minnesota mushroom. And I've been using a lot of them, and I love using them.
Yeah.
And I think it will draw really good flavor to ramen.
Gotcha. And we work with a lot of the local mushroom foragers,
yeah.
And also produce like microgreens. So basically working with a lot of local farmers and local vendors, I think that's for us to bring the piece of Minnesota into the concept and the restaurant
right.
and the food.
Yeah. And that's an idea that even when I was speaking to one of my mentors who's Filipino in Brooklyn, you know, when I asked like how Philippines couldn't be any further from the US. Japan couldn't be any further.
Right.
So how do you bring that culture? And it's really like the ingredients and what's local here. That's how you could meld these two things together, right?
Yeah.
I wonder too, if we were foodies, I mean, we are foodies, that we naturally are hungry for this kind of knowledge. We will research ingredients,
mm-hmm.
right? And
mm-hmm.
so when I went to Japan, even though there was a language barrier, I would go home and Google this stuff. Like, what was I eating,
yeah.
right? And that's for me. But for the average person, how do you put that education to them that, hey, this is what five spice is?
Mm-hmm.
Because remember, we talked a little bit earlier about the hybridization.
Right.
And so you have to be clear on, like, this is Japanese, this is not Thai. Like, how did you go about educating the consumer?
I use social media a lot to
yeah.
educate people. And that's one way I trying to show throughout my process in my, you know, Instagram or Facebook to
mm-hmm.
the general public and say, hey, this week I'm doing this with this kind of ingredient. And this is something in my heritage, or this is some Japanese, you know, products I'm using, or local products I'm using. So I rely on social media a lot in terms of education.
And storytelling.
Yeah, storytelling.
Yeah. yeah.
And
I remember and I don't know if you still do this, in the early days, you were always in the dining room. That's what I always remember.
Right.
Do you still do that?
I try to. Now, you know, I like to be engaging with my customers.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I love seeing our regulars become really good friends. Now I have a good team. I have a really good team. I'm very fortunate, and I don't want to be micromanaging them. So
yeah.
I'm like, okay, you guys do your thing. I'll come and say hi to our regulars and,
yep.
you know, be around. That's why we're still working 7 days.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, that's why I'm here 4 years
yeah.
later, right?
Yeah.
It's that memorable. But the reason I ask that is because when you're speaking with the customers, what have you found are really effective storytelling techniques, or are there certain things you would say to introduce foods to them? Or because I mean, some people approach very hands off.
Mm-hmm.
They make it explicit on the menu, like, oh, this is what you're eating,
yeah.
this is the history. Some people are very, you know, hands on.
Yeah. I think you just have to be genuine.
Yeah,
you know,
being
you
genuine.
You don't have to, you know, purposely tell them, oh, I'm using this, try that.
Mm.
Just be yourself and be genuine about people in general.
Yeah.
It's be courteous.
And being on the floor helps a lot.
Mm-hmm.
When I run the food to the table, you engage with them, and customers will ask questions, or and they'll be like, and they can see that I'm really enthusiastic about answering their questions. I think
yeah.
that helps a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, my style is be genuine,
mm-hmm.
like John said, and be really enthusiastic about what your product, your love.
Yeah.
This is your bowl of love, your dishes, which I love to eat. The,
yeah.
All the dishes on the menu are my favorite, no,
right.
our favorite dishes.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's why I think customers, our guests, they can see, they can tell.
And if they have questions, we try our best to answer the question.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And we're not trying to push anything to their face, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
If they have any question, it's like, oh, why do you use this kind of ingredient in this bowl? And I will try my best to explain to them why.
So.
Of my knowledge.
Yes.
So
yeah.
I think it's a one-to-one clarity right there
yeah.
between customers. You don't, because I don't feel like I have the right to educate anybody.
Ah.
To me, it's more understanding each other. Just like I always bring this up to people. It's like burger, right?
Yeah.
Why do you think this burger is better than that burger? But in whole, it's still the same. It's came with the same thing. You have buns, you have meats, you have ingredients. What makes this different than this one?
Yeah.
So to me, I'm trying not to look into too meticulous of, you know, breaking down of, oh, because of this secret, of
yeah.
that secret.
Yeah.
It's more of what I feel right about, you know, what I do. And if you can taste it, that means I'm successful with that.
Yeah, it's almost looking at the sum of all parts.
Right.
Rather than you know, if we were to talk about like architecture in the building, like getting hung up on like, oh, this is Art Deco, right, so that's not right. going in my building.
Right. Right. Then you don't need architect. You need a, all you need is a contractor.
Right? Right. Right.
Right. If you, same thing as food to me, if you don't care about ingredients, hey, any burger from big box, you know, yeah. chains is still a good burger.
Yeah. 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 You don't need a chef.
Yeah. You don't need a chef.
You just need some machine that can calculate. Right. The thing. Yeah.
It's still edible. It still fill you up. It still have the flavor, you know.
I think that's one thing that oftentimes gets forgotten by a lot of people and I have to keep emphasizing is like a chef is not just the cook, man. Right. There's the storytelling and these are, you know.
Right.
And I think people have reminded me when I say like, oh, no, I'm just a cook. They're like, no.
Right.
Yes, there's the cook, but you're also telling the story of Filipinos and immigrants yes. to you. You know, right. That's something.
Right.
Do you have a story of a time when you were on the floor where someone might have hesitated or saw food differently because of what you said? Like, where maybe they were like, oh, no, I already know Japanese food. Like, where's the sushi at? Is there a story you have or memory where you were on the floor and you helped someone see the light?
It was, I think it was kimchi. There were quite a few things on the menu that, like natto and kimchi, they were hesitant about it. And I'm like, try it. Just give it a try. If you don't like it, it's on me. Mm. You know, or...
And you don't have to like it. You have to do is try it.
Try it. And
life is all about trying anyway. If you never try something, you will never know what it's like.
Yeah.
You know, even though when you travel to Japan, no matter how many times you go travel to Japan, that's only few things you can try.
Yeah.
There's a lot more than that few things you try in Japan. So when you come back and say, okay, when I was in Japan, I tried this. This is different than Japan. But my question is, how many of this you try in Japan?
Mm.
Right? I mean, even though to us, even though local Japanese people will say they don't get to try everything in Japan either.
Yeah.
You know, what to say, which one is authentic, which one is right, which one is wrong, you know.
Yeah. You're listening to Hidden Apron Radio, produced by myself, Paolo Espanola, and Ricky Ho. Just two ordinary guys trying to break bread and break boundaries. Thoughts, musings, ever just wanted to rant at us? Do let us know at hiddenapron@gmail.com or @hidden_apron on both Twitter and Instagram. Back to the show.
Actually, now that you bring up the trip to Japan, I want to see, because this was a question that usually would pose some difficulty when I ask this, is the idea of like frameworks for learning, right? Because sometimes people are very creative and they're like, I don't have a framework. Like the last guest I had, he was like, I don't have a framework. I just go to restaurants and whatever I feel, that's what I'll take. So it's going to be interesting to see how someone whose background was in accounting and finance and someone who has architecture as a background, what your framework for learning is. When you landed in Japan and was going to, you did like a tour of Japan, right?
Right.
Was there some sort of structure for how you said you were going to learn? Did you say, okay, we're going to first focus on most basic ingredients? Or did you say, we want to try the styles of cooking first? You know, what was the structure you placed around learning?
I would say I usually start off with, you know, the research, a feel of the, in my case, ramen shop that I really want to go try. That's how I start. And then, you know, in between that, we will look at, you know, which region we are going to, and then we will start researching of, you know, what is their specialty in that region.
Right.
Then we will try out those kind of food. That's how we develop the kind of schedule, I guess.
Yeah.
In our trip.
Basically, he would tell me, okay, these are the styles of ramen that I want to try, and these are the places, and I will kind of do the itinerary and plan out, okay, we're going to take the earliest train, the Shinkansen, and then take, you know, from Tokyo and all the way down to, you know, Fukuoka.
Yeah.
And like, we're going to do a day trip to Hiroshima, or, you know, we may go up all the way up to Kanazawa. It's basically, we want to, being Asian, being very, you know, want to make sure that we get our money's worth.
Yeah.
You know, like, we were planning a lot of day trips and you know, like, it's...
And research on what they good, which
region
of products they really famous for, I guess.
Yeah,
that will help you to narrow down, you know, what kind of food you should try.
Yeah.
Right, because I think this applies more to Japan, right? When people ask me, like, I'm going to XYZ country, do you have suggestions? I oftentimes try to say, forget my list. Mm-hmm. Here's a framework you can use when learning an unfamiliar culture. Because for you, you know, your introduction to Japanese food, you're like, why was I so excited? There must have been something that guided you, like, oh, let me look at ingredients first. Like, I have, for example, if I'm traveling, I have a Google sheet. And I break it down by meal. Like, these are the breakfast foods. So now I've planned my breakfasts.
Mm-hmm. Right.
These are, you know, these are lunch. And then amongst that, there's a second dimension, regionality. And then it just looks like a really nerdy... Like, I used to work at PwC. So it's I'm on Excel.
Right. I think you're very expert in this.
No, like, when we do our pop-up dinners, even, our menu planning is all Excel.
Wow.
We'll have components on the top, like color. Temperature, and then we'll have variations, and then we'll like connect them and say, okay, what comes out if we do red, hot, Indian, and cilantro? What comes out?
You know? Wow.
But then, people are like, dude, that's so accounting of you.
Right.
You should make an app out of this.
I thought about it because it's one, you know, it's frameworks are what help guide, right? No. So when people say, like, oh no, ramen, that's not for me.
Mm. Right.
Like, no, it's the thinking behind it. Like, your construction of a bowl of ramen is very different from someone who's like, oh, just feel it.
I mean, you don't like to like anything, to try anything.
Yeah.
But you just have to be willing to try it.
Yeah.
And I think for us, really, like, other than ramen, we want to try food that we cannot get in the U.S.
Yeah.
And that's something where, like, okay, this is what we're going to really try, and the ingredient that you cannot get.
Was there something in Japan that, well, what's an example of an ingredient? That
like oyster in Hiroshima.
Yes. And we had pork sashimi. We had whale.
Sakura miku.
Mm.
Yeah.
Oh yes. My gosh.
Yeah. I mean, those are the things we're like, okay, we'll never be able to eat this in the U.S. Yeah. And we're just going to try it. You know, we're not going to be like eating a lot of, I know there are a lot of controversy about eating whale and horse, whatever, but you know what? You're in Japan. They serve it. Just try a little bit of it and see.
It's respectful.
That's it.
We didn't like it either, but we tried it.
Yeah.
We know the flavor. We know the texture. And, you know, we can understand why people liked it, but it's just something that, you know, I think is for their culture that works.
Right.
You know? Yeah. We have not tried chicken sashimi yet.
We did.
Did we?
What is it? Like Ajitori. That's, I mean, we have one in New York, but it's like, there's maybe two people doing it, and it's crazy expensive.
Mm.
Oh, it's literally every part of the chicken, the cartilage, everything.
Oh, wow. I'm sure it's, it's hard to get those really fresh chicken.
It is. It is, because you try getting chicken in the States and do sashimi out of it. Good luck.
Yes.
Looking for a lawsuit right there.
We're reaching the 40-minute mark. And there's a part that I definitely don't want to forget, because we talked about education a while ago. And before we were recording, you were talking about your time on committees with students, culinary students.
Yeah.
And you were talking about MRA. Could you talk about why you felt that, first of all, why you even felt like it was important to do? Because running a restaurant, that's hard. Adding a marriage on top of that, that's it. And now then you're also out there in the community. Like, why did you feel like that was an important thing to do?
My involvement with the MRA started in 2015, where I started to see that I need to speak up as a minority, as an Asian. It was because of the scheduling. They want to do a 28-day scheduling for, you know, any businesses in Minneapolis. And there was a lot of policies such as the minimum wage and the sick and safe leave. And these are the things where I felt that minorities and, you know, don't have a voice. And I need to do something about it. If everyone, you know, we could complain about it. If we don't speak up, nobody will hear you. And that's why I started to get involved with the MRA, because they basically were working together with a group of restaurants, and to really tell them that restaurant industry is different from corporate America.
Right.
We're different from Target. We're different from, you know, Best Buy, and we work differently. And especially micro businesses and small businesses are the ones that are going to suffer if this is going to go through.
Right.
And that's when I'm like, okay, I usually don't like politics. I hate politics. I don't want to speak up. As a woman, as an Asian, I should just shut up and do my thing. That's how I was brought up with my culture. And I don't know how. I mean, they just, you know, talking to a lot of restaurant owners, they're like, you should totally, you know, like join an MRA. And they invited me to sit on the board of directors. And I did my 2 year of really speaking up and telling them how I feel and engaging with local restaurants who are minorities. And, you know, they don't know about all these topics that are going on that will affect their livelihood.
But they saw you as a credible person who's on their side.
Yeah, right? I'm very passionate about it because if those Vietnamese and Hmong owners, business owners, they don't even know about this and the policies pass, they'd be like, what? What happened? How come nobody told us about this? And that's where I felt that my role has kind of developed my role as part of the MRA.
Yeah.
It's really to get engagement and get people to know, okay, these are the things that's going on. Tell us how we feel about it. And speaking up in listening sessions when the city of Minneapolis, they have policymakers talk, they want to have listening sessions and say, hey, tell us what you feel about this. This is what we plan to do. And we'll go to those places and talk to them in a town hall setting and get going to do, you know, seminars, going to different places and really speaking up. I think that's important. And that kind of how I got on board.
And I think it's, so for people who don't know what MRA is, it's not a union. It's basically represents the interests of the restaurant industry.
Yes. It's basically, it's called the Minnesota Restaurant Association. All the different restaurants are members of the association where we have a group effort of advocating and advocating for policies that are going to affect restaurants, that will help restaurants, and even cultivating culinary students. We, you know, the association would donate to culinary schools, scholarships for culinary students. And donations, charities.
Yep. And how about your work with students, John?
I mean, I started sitting on a board in St. Paul Culinary College, part of the member of the advisory instructor over there. It's 2 years now?
Yeah.
It's been two years now.
Not as an instructor, but as...
just an advisory. So I go to the meeting once a while to, you know, talk to the instructor about, you know, how does whole culinary school structure should work in terms of curriculum-wise and reality-wise. So I think my voice was pretty much from the, you know, the real working industry, telling them, hey, it's for you to learn how to cook in a school.
Yeah.
This is only a certain thing you learn, but for us, those are the X amount of question we will have for you to figure out, even though you are in school, in reality.
Preparing them to
mentor them in a way that, you know, for the unexpected world after they graduate.
Right. I think that's a problem that exists in education today, regardless of, you know, cooking, because there's always a disconnect between what's being taught versus what we actually need.
Right.
Like accounting, I forgot FIFO, LIFO, like, day one. Right. I was like, why didn't anyone train me on fund accounting when I was in college, right?
Yeah.
So are there like certain skills, and it doesn't have to be cooking, it could be business management, that you find students today, or even people who are starting restaurants or food businesses, that are, it's like top three that are lacking, that you wish this should be instituted or matriculated?
I think for sure patience. People tend to be lack on patience this day. I think, you know, I you know, a lot of people want to blame the Food Network and all the shows, you know. I mean, it is certainly part of it.
Right.
And I think it's just the whole dynamic of our world right now, because social media is so significant right now. And you can probably get any information you get from the social media, like learning how to sous vide a chicken.
YouTube.
Back in the day when we want to learn how to sous vide a chicken, we don't have a source to go to. We just have to try and error.
Yeah.
So that's the biggest difference. A lot of people will think, okay, I can learn this so quickly, so therefore I shouldn't put as much effort. I think that is not only our industry. I think it's just the overall society right now.
Yeah.
But I think we are trying to get them back to the ground and tell them, okay, this is something you really need to have in order to become a chef in the future. You know, you can learn as quick as you want. You can learn as much knowledge as you can. But when it's come to patience, that is something you have to come within. You have to learn. You have to learn yourself before you learn anything else.
Right. Perhaps it's a message that the instructors should be saying. Because I don't know how to teach patients, right?
Right.
Do you think there's things that in our schools or even, you know, through our mentors that we're not pushing enough on our students?
I really think it's work ethic and really be persistent. Mm-hmm. For me, I show through example. I think you have to be a working example in order to show that. For example, we come in the earliest than anyone else. And when we the first few years, we're always here the earliest and we leave the last.
Yeah.
That's the work ethic that I think is lacking. Like John said, the social media, the instant gratification of a lot of things and attitude-wise where you have to be persistent and don't be discouraged once you fail and think that this is the end of it. You have to keep on your ground and say, you know what? I'm just going to keep trying. I fail. It doesn't mean that I'm a failure. I'm going to keep trying. Yeah. Believe in your principle. Yeah. Because we have gone through a lot of hardship and a lot of tears and blood of like, why are we doing this? Mm. We're not getting ourselves paid enough. This is such hard work. Mm. We could be working for a corporate and make so much more money, but we stick to it. Yeah. And we said, you know what? We decided to do this. Believe in yourself. Keep going. And that's where you'll get to somewhere.
And that's,
I think, in turn, a way of through your work ethic and patience.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's a challenge, though, because if we go to the head of a school right now and we say, our industry needs these two things.
Right.
I don't know how they're going to
change it.
How are they going to put that in the curriculum?
They want to speed up the process.
Yeah.
At the same time, how are you going to teach them those kind of adequate?
Yeah. You know, yeah. I think one story I'll leave for the listeners that I think goes well with this. I was listening to a talk by a philosopher. His name is Alan Watts. He's very big into the Zen philosophy. And he was like, you know, why do people dance? If the point of the dance was the last final step, all right, we'll just jump there. And you know, or why do people listen to music? If it was the final note, let's play the final note.
Mm.
You're supposed the it's the whole thing. Yes. Even the parts that don't sound good, like the dissonance, or in a dance, even the parts that look like, oh my god, they just did a backflip. Right. Like, why is that in there? You know, if there was no mistake, what's the point? If it's just the final bowl of ramen, then
why live your life if you don't want the experience?
I mean,
I agree.
Yeah.
The process. It's the process. Important.
To us, it's always the process more interested than, you know, the outcome.
Right.
The outcome will come if you give enough of your process.
Yeah.
You know, it will show at your work. So
I think you posted a photo of one of your bowls where it was like, you started out with an empty bowl.
Yeah.
Then you put the tire, then you put the broth. Then you're like, that's how ramen is made. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I thought they just put it in.
Right.
You know, what was that movie? You guys have seen Jiro Dreams of Sushi, right?
Yes.
Yeah, you know, the guy who was doing the eggs.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, if he got it right on the first time, I feel like that movie would have been, I would have been like, cool. Mm-hmm. Those are nice eggs, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. But the fact that he like almost cried at the end where he's like, I've been spending years on this.
Right.
He made it that much more poignant. Like now eating tamago at a restaurant, I suddenly keep thinking of him every time.
Right. The process.
Was there something that I failed to ask? For you.
I guess more so is there any more question you would like us
there,
to end?
There is one last section that I ask every episode.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They're very quick and you could choose to answer them long or quick, but I want to make sure too that the message that you're trying to get out in the world, I didn't miss anything. Because, you know, I haven't seen y'all in 4 years. These are all based on just me stalking.
One thing I do still think though, I think a lot of ethnic cuisine is still underappreciated, regardless of who's doing it. I think the fact that maybe it's not the time yet, or people just don't have the grasp of how to approach to it. I think, personally, that's how I think, you know.
In terms of underappreciated is, for example, Asian cuisine are always perceived as being cheap. Prices should be lower.
Homogeneous is like one big...
Exactly.
And also, like this day, Asian cuisine or ethnic cuisine is more about the trend, you know, rather than something consistent, you know, timeless.
Yeah.
Like, just like this few years, Filipino food is such a yes. hot topic right now. But yes. to us, it's like... It should be hot right at the beginning because it is what they eat.
Yeah.
Why not to celebrate it in a way that this is not a trend, but it's something that is approachable for yeah. everybody. And it's, that's the way it should be. And to me, that's how I look at ramen too. The whole idea of ramen got picked up is because of the trend.
Yeah.
But how many of people out there think, oh, ramen is going to be, you know, in the long run, it's going to be something that is prolongable.
Yeah, it's a way for us to remember that this is one right. long human story.
Right.
Yes. And not like, what's the next Instagram hashtag?
Right.
It's not right. something special. Yeah, it's something that we eat every day.
Yeah.
Let's celebrate.
Yeah.
Let's not make it as something special.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. You're going to make a lot of the Filipino chefs who like I complain with in the background very happy. So when you said that, they're going to be like, yes!
I just say what I feel like.
Someone gets it. Good. Anything that I missed?
No.
Okay.
No.
So this last section of questions, I'll ask them quick, but you can choose to take however long you want to answer them. And since there's two of you, I get... bonus because I get two sets of answers. First question is, I'm going to switch this up. Person who most influenced you from a cooking and, if you so choose, an architecture or business standpoint?
For me, business is my father. He grew up as a hippie. He was in London with my mom doing a lot of protesting, and he took over my grandfather's business as a timber businessman and was very heavily involved in politics. So that kind of, I grew up around going to campaigns with him, you know, working around, being in his my grandmother's shop, helping out at the shop. I think that's, you know, my father is the person that influenced me a lot.
Cool.
Yes.
I think to me is Tada Ando, the Japanese architect.
Yeah.
And the reason why I think he's the one that inspired me was because he didn't go to school for architecture. He was a self-taught architect. He was a boxer before he became an architect.
Like a boxer. Like Manny Pacquiao. Oh right. my gosh, wow.
So he actually self-learned. He is a self-learned architect. And
yeah.
and now he see his vision and is so clean and so spiritual in his architecture. And he's so successful. And I guess that is part of me in the industry too, yeah. because I wasn't a trained chef to start with, and then I get into this industry later on in my life, and then I pick up what I gotcha. Know.
How about cooking? Anyone?
Cooking, I think that's a lot. I mean, to me, is I think I learn from everybody else because okay. I'm always learning. To me, I'm always a student.
For me, I don't cook a lot. So he will be the person.
Good answer.
Yeah, I'm a good dishwasher.
Three ingredients to best describe you. Let's start.
Ooh, it will be natto.
Okay.
And egg and beef.
Beef.
Yes.
Okay. For you?
Me, dry fish. I'm dry fish.
Okay.
Well, to me, it's any vegetable.
Any vegetable.
Any vegetable. I love vegetable.
Okay.
I eat more vegetable than meat. And I love rice.
Right. See, I was waiting for someone to say it. This is like a asagohan, you know?
I can't live without rice.
It's a perfect breakfast yeah. right here.
Yes.
If you had to choose one book or documentary or even any resource that you feel like everyone in the world needs to consume this, it doesn't have to be about food. What would it be?
You go first.
I'm thinking.
I can't answer that question yet. So
okay,
I won't be. I can't think of anything than a book, because I don't read a lot.
It doesn't have to be a book. It could be like a show you've seen, or a meal at a certain restaurant that taught you a lot about life. Like one resource that you're like, the common person to become a better person in overall, they should see this.
I read up a lot on self, basically a lot of self-enrichment, reading up about how to become a better person, how to self-reflect, how to be more, I guess, like be a better person to other people. A lot of things I like to reflect on myself. What am I doing? How do I like to be treated? And how that's how I would treat other people.
Yeah.
And that's how I guess what I mean by I don't read a lot of books, but I do read a lot of articles about
self-reflection,
self-development, self-enrichment.
Yeah. I think after the show, if you have like certain blogs that you usually follow, I'll put them into the list.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
To me, I don't read, so I don't watch TV a lot.
You do watch a lot of like...
I like to watch TV program that put a lot of thought to it, like those crime mystery kind of
Forensic Files.
Yeah, those kind
he
of programs.
He loves those shows.
I think I like the fact that because those are involving to very detail oriented steps. So I like to watch shows like that.
He's obsessed with that.
I'm obsessed with that.
For people who need to learn how to be more detail oriented, we always tell them like go read this heavy tome on project management. There you go. Watch some mystery shows. At the very least, this will teach you a little bit about detail. Yeah. Good. Last question, and this is probably going to be the hardest one. If you had to condense your work, it doesn't have to be Zenbox, it could be your whole life, into one line. Same for you. One line. If people were to remember you for this one line as this was their contribution to the world, what would that one line say?
For me, my legacy is to give what I have learned in helping other people to become become who they want to be. I always tell my staff, we don't have any children. You all are like our kids. They call us mom and dad. And I'm like, I've been through all this. And I hate back then when my mom and dad says, when I was young, I was doing this and that. And I'm telling you the same thing because I've been there. But I want you to see that I am trying to get you somewhere to be successful and do what you want to do one day. And I'm being hard on you. I'm throwing you out of your comfort zone because I care about you. I guess it's not one line, but this is what I would like myself to be seen as a mentor.
Yeah.
So
that works. I've seen answers that are one word. Uh-huh. I've seen answers that are one sentence. And I've seen answers that are one paragraph. Yes. Just put a lot of commas in there.
There you go.
I think to me it's more be an underdog.
Be an underdog.
Always be an underdog. Because being an underdog, you will always want to do better than yourself. You always want to keep going.
Yeah.
And there's nothing worse than being underdog.
Yeah.
You know, you can't get any worse. But the only thing is keep moving forward, right?
Yeah.
So I think that, and also the attitude to be an underdog too is like, you don't expect to win anything, but you just have to try the hardest to reach to the next goal. And to me, I think that's my legacy, you know.
Awesome. Yeah. See what I mean? There's a spectrum. So we got two on the show.
Yeah. There you go.
Well, thank you so much. I feel like this wasn't just I always, when I go into these things, I'm like, how can we go beyond just the beyond sushi, beyond the bowl of ramen?
Right.
Really, these are ways to live life. So the next time people eat a bowl of ramen, they think, how can I XYZ, right? Cool.
Right.
So hopefully it doesn't take me another 4 years to get here.
I know.
Thanks for being on the show, and I will...